Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum. Welcome to Pod Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh Ragnarok.
Hello.
WMRR.
How are you dealing with the rain? It's rain in Los Angeles, everybody.
Action news. I love it. I'm from San Francisco. It's totally my... It's the only time I smile.
Okay. We've also got journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Oh, hey there, Guy.
And we've got academic critic and dyke about town Karen Thompson.
How you doing, Guy?
Oh,
I thought
boy.
I'd change it up. I'm just like there to campaign on behalf of A Star Is Born, but whatever.
Oh, my God. Any way they can get it, right?
Any way they can get
okay,
it.
Okay. So the gay male community is being torn apart by Glenn Close's late surge and what this is meaning for Lady Gaga. How are queer women standing?
I think that we're there with Glenn Close, who has been the perennial runner-up so many times over in the Oscars. I think we understand what it means to like be the bridesmaid and never the bride.
Doing all of the hard work, but never getting the notice that Meryl / the boys in Hot Pants get. You know?
Absolutely.
Coming up on this week's show, we've got Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, the new Netflix show about cleaning your house. If we had told people in 1988 there would be TV shows about cleaning your house, they would have said that's as impossible as Donald Trump being president. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Thompson, what are you all about this week?
Well, in the spirit of Marie Kondo, there's only one thing in pop culture currently, even though I'm binging and enjoying a lot of other things, but there's one thing that has sparked my joy. And that, unfortunately, is The Masked Singer on Fox. Frankly, every time I watch it, I am just like, I think, why am I doing this? And then, like, granted, I watch it at the gym, and it's like watching a movie on an airplane. Like, you feel very predisposed to it because you're like, hey, I'm doing something that exerts, like, my energy. Like, you know, this feels like a great respite from that. Anyway, The Masked Singer, for those of you who don't know, is a new reality competition, a singing competition on Fox. And it's based on a South Korean show called King of the Masked Singer. And essentially, it's celebrities, let's use that word loosely, performing in elaborate head-to-toe costumes, masks. You basically can't even see a tiny portion of their flesh peeking through in any way. And their voices are altered while they're speaking when they're doing their packages. So you can't hear whether they're male or female or what their speaking voice sounds like. All you hear, it's like a variation on the voice, is their singing voice.
No stopping me.
Whose voice does that remind you of? Chris Brown, maybe?
200 degrees, that's what it got in Mr. Fahrenheit. I'm driving at the speed of light. I want to make a supersonic man out of you.
This is my favorite one so far.
The judging panel consists of Ken Jeong, Jenny McCarthy, Robin Thicke, and Nicole Scherzinger.
So, yes. And what sort of celebrities have we been talking about here? Or have they not? Has no one been unmasked
okay,
yet?
Okay, two people have been unmasked thus far. Spoiler alert for those of you who haven't been watching. The first is an NFL player whose name I can't even remember at this point.
Our biggest stars.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, in week two, let me shout out Jen J. Walker, Rocketeer extraordinaire, gold star level Rocketeer, Jen J. Walker.
Jen has skills.
Predicted who the second masked singer was.
Oh, okay.
This is what I love about these shows, especially when it comes to Fox. It can't be so lowbrow that it's like a Kardashian and too obvious and annoying, or even worse yet, like an offside Jenner.
I do love the dynamic of, like, celebrities who are on a reality show like this, they're only getting paid for the weeks that they get to stay on, and they're making not quite what you would make for being on a sitcom. Like, they're making, like, 15 grand a week. And I love the stories of people desperately trying to hold on to Celebrity Diving Show so that they can make enough to, like, pay their mortgage.
This sort of, like, third, fourth tier people, like, I am glad to see them on this show as opposed to being, like, my tax attorney or something.
Right.
Margaret Wappler, I have a question for you.
Yes.
What are you all about this week?
I'm all about a thing that didn't spark any joy whatsoever, but it was an important watch, and I'm glad I watched it, and that's the documentary on R. Kelly called Surviving R. Kelly. It's a docuseries. It aired on Lifetime. It was executive produced by Dream Hampton, who's a filmmaker and a writer. And it's, God, you guys, it is just a powerhouse of a thing. It's six shows detailing the sexual allegations that have been leveled against R. Kelly since pretty much 2000 or so. I'm struggling in a way to even talk about this because it is such a monstrous story. It's shocking how big and wide it really is that it's hard to dive in. But basically, the sort of tip of the iceberg that we all know is the sex tape, the infamous sex tape that circulated around 2002 or so that showed him allegedly having sex with an underage girl. And you see in the documentary a woman named Sparkle, who was a protege of his, a singer. She is the aunt of the girl who's allegedly in the video. And she talks about how she introduced R. Kelly to her niece when she was 12 years old, the niece. And they struck up a friendship, if you could call it that. And things really rapidly declined from there. And he eventually went to trial for that. And that's the story that we all know, that he went to trial on child pornography charges, ended up getting acquitted. And part of the reason he got acquitted, and Sparkle talks about this a lot, is because the victim and the victim's parents pretty much said, no, that's not her. They just denied flatly that it was her in the video, even though everyone from Sparkle to the girl's like basketball coach said, this is her. So that's a story that everyone knows. And once he got acquitted from those charges, it's like it gave him permission to dig even deeper into this disgusting, predatory behavior that he's been engaging with all along, which is basically finding girls anywhere from 14 to 17 years old, grooming them, promising them that he'll work on their album with them. A lot of them are aspiring singers or rappers, and then taking them under his wing and manipulating them to the point that he just sort of psychologically breaks them down and sexually abuses them and talks them into doing all kinds of things that they, you know, wouldn't in a regular consenting mind do. At this point now, he is accused of running basically a sex cult out of different households in Chicago and Florida. And some of the women have escaped from that sex cult and talked about the treatment that they suffered there. I mean, it's just kind of unreal. It's like everything from like, they can't go to the bathroom when they want to go to the bathroom. They get starved if they offend him. They have to call him daddy. I mean, he breaks these women down. And each one of them that have escaped, you know, are there to tell their story. And it's so powerful to listen to their story. Another person in the documentary is Andrea Kelly, who is his ex-wife. And she has three children with him. And she talks about how she suffered all of this treatment as well. So it's just staggering the kind of breadth and width of the abuse that he's leveled on these women. And it's also, it has these weird parallels to me to like the Catholic Church scandals. Mm-hmm. Because he was treated basically and is treated like a god in his community. He was this boy who grew up in the Chicago Projects who came from nothing and had this amazing gift, this amazing voice, this songwriting talent, and became, you know, larger than life, this R&B powerhouse. And so when he comes up to these girls at concerts, I mean, some of these girls he's just met like as he's pulled them on stage. And that's like, that's enough contact for them to just get sucked into his world. It's like the minute they see him and meet this real life God and he says, you know, come with me. It's like, you know, they call him the Pied Piper because he just sort of leads children away with this beautiful music, never to be seen again. And, you know, the cops are in on it.
He calls himself the Pied Piper because he's attached to that story, too, right?
Yeah,
that's one of the things that he perpetuates as like a kind of mythos around himself.
Yeah. And this is something that's really fascinating about the documentary is, you know, everyone's asking, how did he get away with this? How has he gotten away with this for so long? And it's not only because like the Catholic priest, he sort of has the cooperation of a lot of enablers and powerful people around him. It's also that he was doing this in sort of plain sight. It was like so audacious that in a way we all kind of looked past it. Like Trapped in the Closet, you know, his crazy video where there's just like all sorts of, you know, just psychosexual madness going on. Like he basically put that kind of content out there and sort of dared us all to sort of say, what's really going on behind the curtain?
It sucks because if anybody you talk to who's from Chicago or from down in Davenport, Florida, where he relocated after the sex tape came out, they're like, this is just what he did.
Yeah.
This is just how he behaved. This is just how he was. And the biggest fallout, because this, you know, an R. Kelly uproar happens every couple of years, especially since the P tape, is that he, you know, has this legion of women and men, primarily in the Black community, that just think that because he made them dance and because he makes all these songs that people love, that there's just either there's no way these, you know, hoes be lying. I saw that a lot. Mm-hmm. Or that, you know, it's just, you know, people creating, you know, trying to take another Black man down. And it's like it the part that makes me the most upset. There's two part. One, the good thing that this did is it put it on such a wide scale. You know, Dream did a fantastic job of just going like just step by step, layer by layer, and producing this in such a way where it's like undeniable.
Yeah,
this was deeply researched, you know, deeply sourced, and she got actual victims to speak. So that really sort of put a pin on that. But mm-hmm. the bad is that here we are, you know, almost 30 years after OJ, where it was so fucking clear at this point. Maybe in 1996, it was a hard time trying to figure out what was going on. But the man has all but admitted, I did it. And people are like, oh, yeah, maybe he did do it. It's like we have to, especially in the Black community, start just really addressing our oppressors, even if they look like us.
And I think that that's one of the things about the documentary that was really important and salient is that it was about the extent to which we ignore these things if it comes from a community of Black women who are speaking about their oppression and speaking about, you know, like the forms of their manipulation. Mm-hmm. It's the sense that, you know, we can recognize misogyny in other places. People made the point many times over in the documentary that if R. Kelly were accused of doing this to white women, it would have been a completely different outcome. But the fact it was young Black women who in our contemporary, in our historically and in a contemporary moment, like devalued by the culture at large, that, you know, that there's some sense of like being able to dismiss any of these charges precisely because, you know, there's some like hierarchy of understanding and truth that excludes Black women explicitly.
It's all historical. Yeah. It's all that women, the Black, young Black women are temptresses and like it and are sexually provocative and are, you know.
And also a construction that men have the capacity for greatness and women have the capacity to take things from men and nothing else.
Right.
You know,
or like, to like hitch their wagon to their greatness and that's it.
Which I'm not doubting that these girls, some of these girls wanted to get with him and wanted to, but he's in a town where that is.
I mean, it's so. I've not watched the documentary and not paid attention to R. Kelly, but it sounds really similar to Bryan Singer or like you know Michael
Kevin
Jackson
Spacey.
Was a different, but like Bryan Singer is definitely somebody who like targets. You know, he's part of a sort of white gay scene, and he targets like young men who don't have the opportunities that heterosexual guys moving to LA do, and takes advantage of the fact that he can like present cool opportunities and stuff like that. And you know, no one's ignoring everyone's ignoring the fact that like he's a grown-up adult who should be able to say to a, you know, 17-year-old or whatever, like who wants to ride on a private jet? Like no.
Yeah,
let's wait 3 years.
Yeah. And
there's the really chilling scene that I remember from that documentary. Actually, is that the white juror?
Yes, I was just about to bring that up.
Yeah,
I just didn't believe them, the woman. I know it sounds ridiculous the way they dress, the way they act. I didn't like them. I voted against. I disregarded all what they said.
fucking horrific.
It's horrific. It's astounding.
Look, I was an R. Kelly fan.
Me too.
I mean,
especially growing up in Chicago.
Since I was 12 years old. But there was always, just like Bill Cosby, there was always something in the back of my head saying something about this ain't right.
Well,
and it's, and I can't believe at almost 40 years old, I'm just, my gut is gut check again on this.
I had friends in the late 90s.
I mean, I've known for years, but I'm just saying.
That like worked on a music video of his.
Yeah.
And they came back being like, that guy's not okay. Like something is off.
Of course.
And that stayed in my mind. And then when I wrote about music in Chicago, and I should say like Jim DeRogatis, who's not in this documentary because he apparently is making his own with BuzzFeed soon to come out. He was the former Chicago Sun-Times reporter who broke the story on the sex tape and other things with R. Kelly. He, you know, it was like an open secret once his story came out, even before his story came out, actually, that like R. Kelly had issues with underage girls. Mm-hmm. Like that was just out there in the news.
Well, Aaliyah, right?
Yeah, Aaliyah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's actually how the documentary begins, is like the first episode digs into that relationship. Because I think at that point, everyone was sort of like, oh, yeah, it's not good that he's with this 15-year-old girl, but he's 27 and they just have a special connection.
It's very great balls of fire.
But nobody
Well, that's the thing that we sort of don't acknowledge, is that these were relationships that were sanctioned by society until not that long ago.
Yeah.
Like most states still have shit on the books that say you can get married at 14 if your parents are cool with it.
Right. Yeah.
And if there's a millionaire involved, your parents might be cool with it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, the Aaliyah story is chilling too, because it talks about how they faked her documents so that they could get married when she was 15. They'd fake the documents to say she was 18.
And it's so interesting because I think about, look, her life was cut way too short and she was on to something. Like, she was gonna be whatever Beyonce is now. She was like on her way.
But she looks so haunted to me now.
Yes, she looks haunted. Thank you, Mara. Like, that's exactly what I was going to say. I started looking at pictures of her recently and I just said to myself, man, like, she was escaping some darkness,
mm-hmm.
that in processing some darkness that just haunted her all the way to the very end. And I, you know, the one thing I'll say about Chicago, I love Chicago. It's a great town.
Mm-hmm.
But Chicago is dark, man.
No, I know.
And people
don't
talk about, I know you know, but people don't talk about like this. There's like an element of shade and like grime that covers that city that it's different than New York, which is like been there, seen it all, very loud. We'll talk to you about it. But Chicago is very much like there's some dark shit happening right around the corner from this pub and everybody knows about it. And soon if you get too close, you might know too. And that's how I felt about watching that documentary.
Elevated train. Make a city insidious. Winter Mitchell, you about something this week?
I watched the MIA documentary, which is multiple years in the making. MIA has sort of been on off the grid lately. Last time I felt like I was super interested in whatever was happening in her life was figuring out what's going on with her being married to a billionaire. She was married to Edgar Bronfman's son Benjamin.
What a beautiful second act, a classic Selma Hayek.
Okay, they're divorced now. But
it's a second act. You gotta get that third act.
Right. But she, you know, the documentary follows her upbringing. She came from really humble beginnings in Sri Lanka. She's born to, you know, parents. Her father wasn't really around. He started out as, I believe, an educator and then sort of switched gears, as parents are known to do, and became a Tamil tiger, a.k.a. activist, a.k.a. gun runner, maybe? I don't know. And she ended up moving to London and growing up in sort of like semi impoverished in London. But what I loved the most about the documentary, it really showed from her own words, like where she is basically coming from. And one thing about documentaries about someone who's a pop star or a musician is they have a tendency to just get really saccharine-y and like really, you know, treacly. And hers was very much like, look, was really passionate about art, very intelligent young woman. I mean, this girl is super, super smart. And she talked about how she, you know, one day her radio was stolen and all she listened to was pop music in the early 80s. And then she heard for the first time, the night that she couldn't get that radio back is the first time she heard hip hop because someone was playing it down the street. And then she started getting interested into Wu-Tang and it developed her and she kind of started adopting like this ghetto fab aesthetic. I find her very intriguing because I love her music and I understand like what her music is representing for her culture and like where she's from. And I play her. She's probably in my top 10 that I play just religiously.
Annually on Spotify,
4 to 5 tracks always appear. She's definitely like super impressive. And I love the way like she handled the, you know, the Madonna finger thing at Super Bowl and how like I was expecting like what. And my favorite part, this is all the reason to watch the documentary if you decide to find it, is streaming now, is when the she finishes the performance and the guy, the official, comes in and let her know, hey, so, and he does it in a total Bob from Office Space way, just basically like, you know, like the the finger. And she's like, I'm sorry, what? And then they're like, yeah, the finger, there's a problem, this is a really special occasion. And she's like, okay. And then she's like, I gotta finish getting dressed. And then he leaves and then they exit the building so fast so she doesn't have to deal with it. And then when they start calling her, like her attorneys and her team and everybody telling her like, look, this is a bigger deal than you think it is, we're gonna get fined and blah,
remind
blah, blah.
Me what the finger thing was though.
Madonna performed Super Bowl, and she started singing that stupid Madonna song that Madonna came up with just for the NFL. And then she like flipped off the camera during the performance, and they fined her. It was 15 seconds of her verse, so she got fined $1 million per second. $15 million. They settled, but like she was fined $15 million for her entire part where she leading up to because she did this for a second.
Jeez.
So she literally goes back to the hotel and they cut. And this is what I love about her. This is, to me, the documentary should have been called Zero Fucks Given. Instead of cutting to like frantic conversation between lawyers and attorneys and the point of view of the like the management and money and money, they cut to her talking to her son and she's like, "Did you watch Mommy on the Super Bowl?" And he was like, "Nope, thought it was boring." And then they cut to her on the couch just laying prone on the phone listening to her team like not interested. And then she's like clicking off the news about herself to watch something else. This is why I fucking love this woman. And when you look at somebody like her compared to like Amy Winehouse, and they came up sort of around the same time, it's just refreshing to see somebody from Brixton who's just like a little bit more with it.
Okay. So this week, my all about, I would like to begin with a prologue before we get to my actual all about. So there's been a lot of discussion of Kevin Hart and the Oscars. Like, they announced Kevin Hart as the Oscars host. And then anyone who had watched Kevin Hart over the past 10 years or paid attention to his Twitter feed was like, hey, wait, he says a lot of mean things about gay people. And Kevin Hart didn't apologize because he said he had already apologized, though no one's seen the apology, and said he was not going to apologize again. And this, of course, was all annoying. That is not what the prologue is. The prologue is that last week he talked to Terry Gross on NPR, and they had a conversation, and she was very Terry Gross about things, and she brought up a joke where he said if he saw his son playing with a dollhouse, he would pick up the dollhouse and hit him with it. Mm-hmm. And the thing is like, that was, of course, very evocative for a lot of gay men because a lot of us have had been in that situation.
Yeah.
Had a, you know, it's like our oppressors are our family members. The people who are attacking us are adults while we are children, blah, blah, blah. And Terry Gross asked him to explain what was funny about it.
Jokes are funny because they're based on truth. And
they're based off of moments that you've had.
Right, but
That's what comedy is. That's where it comes from.
But saying that you're going to break the dollhouse over your son's head if you think he's gay, or that you have to stop it, you have to prevent your son from being gay. The reason why it's not funny to a lot of us is, you know, a lot of people, is that it's not like there's no truth in that. You can't, if someone's gay, you're not going to prevent them from doing it.
I think that that is a really problematic way of talking about things that were part of mainstream comedy 10 years, 20 years ago, to just resolutely say, I don't see what's funny about that. Because the thing is that 10 or 20 years ago, Terry Gross was laughing at those things. She was having people on her show who made jokes like that, and she wasn't calling them out on it. And we as a society let shit like that go. Mm-hmm. And being able to talk about the growth process and the change process and what actually are the forces behind a laugh like that. And, you know, there's so much conversation about how do we talk about the dangerous things? How does comedy do the job of talking about things that are hard or harsh? And last week I watched a movie from 20 years ago that did such a lovely job of it that I just wanted to, like, bring it back so everybody could think about it. The movie is The Opposite of Sex. With Christina Ricci and Lisa Kudrow. And the basic story is that a horrible 15-year-old girl shows up at her gay half-brother's house, seduces his boyfriend away, and then convinces the boyfriend that the baby she was already pregnant with belongs to him. And just sort of ruins the life of everyone around her. But what I had forgotten was this arch and horrible, terrible voiceover of this sort of like terrible girl from a religious Louisiana background and the way she was talking about fags. And it was so wonderful to hear out of this venomous but fun creature all of the worst things that were thought about fags, and to use that as a starting off point for having a real conversation about what these people's relationships were. When I saw it for the first time, I was either not quite out of the closet or barely out of the closet. And it was just like fun diva, you know, fun movie with like a too big female character. I love it. But when I was watching it this time, it's one of the few movies I've ever seen that like really tackles the big whys. Like, you know, because it's essentially about a relationship between a dude and a much dumber guy who he wanted to fuck after he lost the man who was his soulmate to AIDS. And there are some really great conversations between the male lead, I forget his name, and Lisa Kudrow about, like, what is sex? What does it mean? Lisa Kudrow has this speech about how, like, sex destroys lives. Like, sex is a dangerous and powerful thing, but what do we so why do we do it? And in the end, it takes this lovely sex positive view and really does make a beautiful argument that it is this magical cement with which we make relationships, and it has a power of its own. But the whole message of the movie would be less good if it were Lin-Manuel Miranda saying love is love is love.
Yeah.
The fact that it had this venomous creature saying all of the things that people were saying in public discourse then brought life and electricity to it. And of course, the thing that makes it okay is that the writer-director Don Roos was a gay guy and that this, like, the sensibility of gay men was behind it. I think we have to continue to have the capacity to make the mean jokes and say the hard things, but think about what the jokes are saying. Because the thing that's funny about hitting your gay son with his gay dollhouse is, ha ha ha, I don't want to have that in my life. Ha ha ha, it is so good that that fate was visited upon other people and not me, and I will try to keep it from being visited upon my children. And like, that's a sour, terrible laugh, but it's a laugh that we were doing for a really long time. So let's talk about it.
I mean, one of the things that I've like really emphasized, because I'm teaching an intro to U.S. popular culture class right now, and one of the things that I underscore to the students that I'm teaching is that we can't think that pop culture is a story of evolution.
Yeah.
That it just becomes woker and woker as time goes by. And all the things that people confronted in earlier eras in the idioms and the historical context that they confronted them in were bad. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so how do we encounter these things that have what we would say are problematic expressions or things that it's just like, oh, that's like, ooh, that's very controversial what you're saying or whatever. The whole notion of being problematic. And the thing is just like what pop culture does is it gives us the tools fundamentally to, or our relationship to pop culture and being involved in it gives us the tools to understand how we can interrogate our feelings around and our responses to these things that make us laugh, have these emotional responses, but without like taking those immediately at face value and understanding that fundamentally, like what we can do with it is like enjoy but have a conflicted and also contradictory set of feelings and responses to these things, that understand that like what is on the surface isn't always the message that we take away from it as a viewer, as somebody who imbibes in it. And I think that that's like the beautiful thing about it fundamentally. Like, I watched Raw when I was growing up and I fucking laughed at that as a young budding homosexual.
So did I.
And then I also identified with, or rather in the words of like a great queer theorist, Jose Munoz, I disidentified with, you know, woo, woo, woo. Like, I was like, I see myself in that. I see the violence that's being directed towards that. And I'm developing my relationship.
20 minutes of the entire special is him criticizing homosexuals, and I just can't watch it anymore. And maybe I don't think it's being a performative ally. It's that I grew up where, look, my mom and dad will fully admit they laughed at it. We all laughed at it. But at the same time, I never laughed at it like, because I don't like gays.
Exactly.
It was definitely like, there are gay people who are like that. But now I can't even watch it.
The Terry Gross of it is what bothers me. The concept of wokeness, the concept of fixedness.
You think she's being performative?
Yes. And I think she's
moralistic and not performative.
Yeah, moralistic. She's behaving as though she's always been fixed instead of saying, I've earned the Terry Gross that I am. All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. When we come back, we are going to be talking about the tinying magic of Marie Kondo.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day, and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell-Rorba,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
And Netflix has brought us a brand new series from author, declutterer, and now TV star Marie Kondo. She's amassed a fortune by inspiring people to throw their crap away and asking the simple question, does this object spark joy in you? Margaret Wappler, I turn to you and I ask, does tidying up with Marie Kondo spark joy in you?
Yes, it does. I'm a fan of the show. I don't, you know, I always knew about her book and now books. And I think it was the kind of book that just about everyone bought my mother at a certain point. And so I always saw it at my mom's house, like tucked into the mess of her home. And I didn't ever really find the book very interesting because I just, for me, like reading a book all about tidying up is like, no thanks. I would read a magazine article about it, yes. But the show I find really, really charming because Marie Kondo herself is just this sort of like sprightly, very beautiful like presence that comes into these homes and basically gives these people a guide and a way to declutter their lives. And I am a big fan of throwing things away myself. Like, I am not a keeper of things. It's something in my own life that has played a big role. I mean, I was mentioning my mother because I was constantly, as a child and as an adult, like fighting with my mother to have her get rid of things. Now somehow I married a guy who also likes to hang on to things, and we're always battling around that. And so it's just like it's I think if it's been an issue in your life, and I think it is an issue in a lot of people's lives, just like what you do with the things in your home, you're gonna find it interesting. I find it also just like very relaxing to listen. I could watch her and listen to her fold clothes all day.
The magic of Marie Kondo is that there's no fighting. Like, it is the amazing transformative thing about this show is that an American, like, reality show doing the same thing, like Hoarders, yells at you and browbeats you. And she comes in and, like, respects you and just gives you some rules. I love that the show is entirely about practice and not process. Mm-hmm. And I would like to say that for 20 years now, I have been calling Shinto as the religion that Southern California would co-opt and colonize next. But I mean, honestly, Kabbalah lasted longer than I thought it would. But I think that like Marie Kondo, who worked as a miko, an attendant maiden, at a Shinto shrine for like 7 years, is bringing this like non-confrontational approach to purity and cleanliness. And like watching it, the thing that made me happiest were the witchcraft moments. When she introduces herself to the house.
Oh my God.
When she wakes up the books, when she thanks a shirt for its service.
I cry almost every time she gets down, kneels, and says hello to the house.
I cry every time. The way that the different families have responded to it, I love. Karen is trying very hard to get in here.
I'm going to be the fuss budget, like, person when we do the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval who does the anti-argument to this shit because yeah. Frankly, like, it's beautiful and charming that you guys are so moved by Marie Kondo and like weep at her presence and her spirituality, but I find it like, number one, maybe I just have a reaction to Japanese colonizers because I'm Filipino. But number two,
that's really the base of it. Really, I'm gonna take it back.
But also part of it is like, I feel like the fact that, Margaret, you can like watch episodes and stay awake through them is really like confounding to me, because I just like, no matter what time of day I start one, and I fucking fall asleep. Mm. Number two, I'm a Virgo and I'm already incredibly tidy. So her system sometimes coalesces with mine and diverges from mine. And I find that very disturbing. Mm. And number three, like, I do come from a family of deep and real hoarders, where it's just like, I've contemplated sending them to hoarders, like as a show. And like, you know, I was like, should I get this book for my parents? No, because it will just end up in the giant hoard somewhere in the backyard next to the big screen TV from 1986 and like the, you know, treadmill. But I feel like there's something about this show that to me feels deeply sinister.
Sinister? Oh.
Sinister all around. As someone who loves cleanliness and tidiness and to clean, and who lives a life of like basically doing the things that are already instructed on the show, I find the sudden reaction to it, like, I don't know, it like takes me aback in some way.
Why?
And I'm just like, I do feel like it is something about like an appropriation of that spirituality that you're talking about, that, or like this sense of being moved. But like, Marie Kondo just seems like another like Asian chick to me, and not very special. I don't know. Okay. I'm sorry. It's horrible.
I'm going to say there are significant problems with the show. I don't think the problems are Marie Kondo's. I think the problem.
You sound horrible.
No, you don't. I mean, it's very interesting, though.
I think the problem was like, Netflix doesn't it doesn't have enough development execs, and it doesn't develop its shows hard enough. There's a lot of boredom to this show. There's a lot of, unlike, you go through four shows where they do step one and step four, and you don't fucking see step two until like episode four.
Or like bra folding until like the end.
But let me say, Karen, you did not watch them in the proper order. And the thing you need is episode two is the fucking Akiyamas. And there is nothing so wonderful as Marie Kondo walking up and her translator explaining, this is a Japanese American family. She's like, oh, it looks kind of Japanese. They don't have a nameplate, though. And then it's just this like wonderful conversation. And when she greets the house, of the six episodes I saw, it was the only time where everybody like knelt down and were like, God, we don't do this much anymore, but like, let's engage in this practice. I loved when the African American family who had moved from Michigan to Los Angeles.
That,
yeah, that like when they saw somebody doing something that they didn't really understand, they lowered their heads and they held hands with each other because like, something's going on here. And I do think
that seemed like a sham to me.
No, I love the fact that she is saying these things like, she is changing the game of what the emotional process is, because the story we are expecting is sort of like, the pain of taking this away. And she's focusing on things like thanking the books. I think thanking the books is so fucking good because it changes the story of what letting go of this thing is. Winter, did you like this show?
can't think a book you hadn't read yet. So that stays there. That's canceled. That's done. We're not even going to talk about that.
Do you approve of waking up the books by hitting them?
100%. I mean, literally, I sat there and watched it with Alan, and he said, you know, he said, clutter is hard on the economy. And I said,
he's right.
I said, fuck the economy. And then we didn't speak for the next 15 minutes and watch this in silence. Look, at the end of the day, it's not okay to be a clutterer. I agree. But the one thing that this woman, who I have deep respect for, because I do think that her process works, and it works if you work it. It's like AA. But if you are, moved to LA with all the shit I had, and I caught my parents and my grandparents multiple times attempt to throw things that had sentimental value to me. And that triggered me. It triggers me anytime somebody tries to take something from me. So when she, you know, makes these comments, I understand her heart and where she's coming from, and I respect her authority. But there are some things that you just can't part with, and we have to figure out what to do about
that.
Look,
it all goes back to Wendy Akiyama. When Wendy,
can't just fucking thank this thing that your dead grandmother gave to you.
Yes,
give it to the world.
No,
why not though?
If you're ready to let it go, why not? But when Wendy Akiyama has the biggest pile of clothes that Marie Kondo has ever seen, and Wendy says, it just makes me feel so good that I have these, like, Marie's not arguing with her.
No.
Marie's not telling her you have to have fewer Christmas decorations, even though she clearly thinks Wendy should have fewer Christmas decorations.
Because who doesn't?
And I think it's good for people to see, like, on scripted television, we see these homes that are curated, and everyone thinks that that's what real people's homes are like. And I think that my mom, being somebody who very tidily hoards, seeing Wendy Akiyama's home and realizing, oh, this other California lady is in the exact same situation I am. She wears long flowy tops and like capri jeans as well. That like it would change the way.
My mom too.
No, Karen, it's why you need to love this show. Because nobody has been more California baby boomer than Ron and Wendy Akiyama. Like they are fucking perfection. And the other great thing about the Akiyama episode is like you're watching it and I'm like, okay. Like, these people are second or third generation Japanese American. It means that someone in their recent familial past was put in a camp and had all possessions torn away from them.
Yes, yes.
Like, what
they is... They showed that, like, where he has that box.
But not in the way that an American reality show would have done.
I'm pretty sure this was my father's. Mm-hmm. When I started looking into it, this is December 7th, 1941.
That was Pearl Harbor.
Thank you.
And then he begins to tell that they were going to be interned at San Ynez or racetrack and what happened to them, you know, right after the break of World War II. So.
This is an item that should be cherished.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
An American reality show would have pumped the tears for the story of they had everything taken away from them. And like the extent to which her game is just validating your deal, but also helping you with the stuff that you don't give a shit about and very small boxes.
Look, I deeply appreciate that. I deeply appreciate that because I like fundamentally share Marie Kondo's ethos is the idea that you can keep things of sentiment and you can really deeply emotionally evaluate each object. And as long as you process that, in this situation, that's like a fundamentally like lovely thing. The one aspect of it, though, is just like that. I mean, I guess I don't know. I guess I'm not the target audience for it precisely because my reaction formation to growing up in a household that was about like understanding scarcity, moving around too much, getting rid of a lot of stuff, and then suddenly keeping everything because it had sentimental value or we understood how much it was worth.
Yeah.
Like my reaction formation to that was just to be like a like kind of fascistic minimalist. Many of you have been to my house. You know what that looks like. But also like that's a real thing because you know when Sarah was watching it too. I mean, she tweeted about this. She was just like, "I'm afraid to watch Tidying Up by Marie Kondo because I feel like I could be sent to a level of insanity that my already very neurotic mind. Like we don't have a single fucking dirty dish in our."
I gotta jump in. So sorry.
Yeah, of course.
I live with someone who has literally been diagnosed OCD.
Yeah.
OCPD. So this is someone who you...
What's the PD?
Personality disorder. It's embedded also, in his DNA.
He's a cop as well.
Yeah. I mean, he's just like, Ocean City PD. I get it. Okay. This person is like, I will clean a dish to the best of what I think is clean, which is normal clean. Mm-hmm. This dish will now go through the Rohrabaugh method, which is washing it again with soap, letting it dry, and then maybe putting it on putting it in the dishwasher.
We can live with Alan very peacefully.
Oh, you'd be fine. You'd never know he's there. And the thing is, like, when we lived in my Hollywood dump apartment, like, I didn't realize to what extent, we laugh about it now, but to what extent, you know, I'm not messy, but I have clutter, and to what it was really messing with him on a fundamental mental level. But now it's like swapped, and I'm like, don't fucking, like, you're going into, don't get, stay out of my shit. Like, don't do, like, what are you doing? I'm not throwing this away. Like, stop.
Margaret and Winter, what was it like watching the show with opposite sex partners?
Well, I watched most of it by myself.
Okay.
David wasn't very interested. I mean, like you, he was just sort of like, what is the big deal about this show? He watched it for like maybe 15 minutes with me, and he thought it was really like funny, like campy in a way.
Well, the thing I love about it is like the men on the like in the first episode, which is the episode I liked least.
Interesting.
The dude.
The first episode has caused a lot of clamor.
I hated first episode.
People have really like.
That's where I couldn't get past it.
Like, yeah, people don't like that couple.
I like that the dude was fine to throw things away, and that the woman really enjoyed the witchcraft. And I think that sort of response, how people respond to like the gentle witchcraft of Marie Kondo.
Well, I think that like one of the interesting through lines about the show is how often you see women feel responsible solely for the state of the home.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I mean, that first show I thought was interesting, and I think sparked a lot of conversation because the attitude between them was basically like, I'm the man, I go off and work 50, 60 hours a week, but my wife is not keeping a good handle on this home, so I gotta step in and get somebody like Marie Kondo in here to help us sort this mess. And she was sort of like another little girl, you know, like she cares for these two young children, and it was like there was this weird sort of like, she's also a child that he has to sort of sternly be like, you need to do the laundry, not pay someone to do the laundry.
Where by the end of things, Wendy Akiyama was like, this really brought out
Wendy. Look, you're basically building your whole case around this
episode.
If Wendy
Yakimata's shoulders.
She's got to keep it all.
If Wendy were doing, I tweeted this, if she were doing an evening of jazz standards and banter in the valley, I'd go. But her saying that, like, Ron has found so much creativity in this, like, honestly, as somebody who lost my dad a couple of years ago, watching this couple who were Californians who were the same age love each other and respect each other, so great. Margie from Culver City, who was a bit too stewardess for my taste, but Margie going through the process of getting rid of her husband's stuff. I mean, like, I told my mom to watch the Akiyamas and Margie, so because like my mom has had to go through that process of like, what do I do with all of these slacks?
But
that's heartbreaking.
That's heartbreaking.
That episode was actually the hardest for me to get through.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And part of it was because I wasn't as like tuned into her as just a personality, but also because it's like the grief aspect of it was just hard to watch.
I think one of the things I like about this show is that, like I said, it's a reality show that's working by different rules, and people are having to do all of the reality showness themselves. And I think that first couple played reality show very hard. And I think Margie the widow was trying to give you Midwestern smiles and, you know, like sort of like false everything's fine. She also did a lot of prayer hands bowing to Marie Kondo, which is really not okay. But by the end, she was kind of like had broken herself down and was sort of like being more honest about her feelings about her husband being gone. And I loved it.
Did you see the episode with the two gay young men?
God, yes.
They were so adorable.
The gay men.
Yeah. I couldn't take, like, this is one thing about the show that I feel like, okay, so there's Hoarders where, like, the people are truly living in, like, slovenly conditions that are, like, about to get condemned, or they have, like, 40 dogs or whatever, mm-hmm. and, like, you are legitimately worried for these people.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh my God, what is going to happen to this person? I never felt that way with any of these people on Marie Kondo's show.
But
you're
kind
of like, oh, whatever, they got to clean out their kitchen. Like,
no.
Life is hard, who gives a shit? But, like, that gay couple to me was like, I'm not worried about these boys.
But
they are fine.
But also,
same with the lesbian couple, frankly.
I didn't get to watch the lesbian episode, but I like that the gay boys, papers were their problem.
Right.
Like, theirs were books and papers and ideas were the thing that they clung
because
to a little too
cute.
Hard.
Frank does not let go of any papers. He still has notes from, like, high school, and he puts a lot of emotion and memories in those notes.
I'm aware of my problem, I guess, because I see them stored all over the house. So I knew the amount was too high, but in order to veil that from myself, I increased the number of locations.
But I mean, like, so I watched the lesbian couple episode, and, like, for me, like, I thought, okay, they present as incredibly tidy. Their problems were super minimal. I mean, there's a reason that it's the last episode, because it feels like a real easy washover, and it's just like, should we split closets up? That kind of thing.
Right.
Which is, frankly, Sarah and I came to that conclusion, like literally to, like, when we were on winter break, we're like, we're going to split closets up because, you know, we'll make it clean, you know. And so there just seemed to be such a fundamental lack of real conflict. And it was really like just an opportunity for Marie Kondo to show how to fold multiple kinds of bras and put them away.
I found that very helpful.
Which
though,
I guess is helpful, but I'm also just like, this seems
like
a
fundamental way. But
I'll never do
it. I will never fold bras like
and
that.
And you'll never like have them on display in color like no. Laird in a tiny box lid.
We'll be right back after this.
Hey, it's Jesse, the host of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I'm coming to Portland, Oregon. We're going to be doing a very special live episode of Bullseye, my NPR interview show. It's taking place Friday, February 15th at Revolution Hall. What are you going to see if you go to Portland, Oregon to see this show? You will see me live on stage talking with folks like Corin Tucker from Slater Kinney, director Lance Bangs, writer Bill Oakley, Simpsons legend. We will also have live music from Roseblood and live comedy from Katie Wen. It's going to be a blast and a half. It's also part of a big podcast festival called Listen Up Portland. Tons of other great podcasts are playing at it too, our pals the Doughboys, among others. So, again, that's Friday, February 15th at Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon, 7 p.m. Tickets are on sale now. Get them at listenupportland.com. And thanks.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell-Rorbaugh.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Thompson.
During the break, we were talking about Pacific Heights, a 1980s or early 90s thriller about San Francisco tenants' rights law. And we're not going to talk about it here, but that's the best concept for a movie ever. But instead, we are asking the members of our panel what their current jam is. So I turn to my old friend, Winter Mitchell.
Yes.
Rorbaugh. And I ask Winter Mitchell Rorbaugh, what is your current jam?
Okay, so there's this really awesome video on Instagram. It's actually on Donatella Versace's Instagram page.
Donatella.
And it is Shalom Harlow on set shooting the Versace campaign. My assumption is going to be either spring or fall. Anyway, she...
But in the 90s, right?
No. Recently.
Really?
I want to say like in the last month. And it is mesmerizing. You have no idea. Like, see, we get like tastes and dalliances, and we get like, you know, Alme commercials and an occasional, you know, Miss America appearance or whatever from these supermodels, or a Kate Moss stumbling out of, you know, a Chateau Marmont photo. But we don't get supermodels from the classic era of supermodeldom to show up in you know, on the job. And Shalom Harlow was one of the more silent ones. She wasn't very,
She was the host of VH1's House of Style.
True. But yes. She was more, but I would say that when I say silent, I mean, like, you weren't getting a lot of the Naomi, the Kate.
There wasn't a lot of personality. It was just the shock factor of a Jewess.
Exactly. Exactly. And
it's
she
like the George Eliot novel.
Killing it. She's not the best dancer, but you can tell that every time she's attempting a rhythm to this song, it's going to make for some beautiful, like, coverage of this campaign.
Yeah.
She's back. She recently joined Instagram, and sidebar, so did Michelle Pfeiffer today. It was amazing.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, the song is called Wordy Rappington by the Tom Tom Club. And I really feel like she knew what this song was like when it dropped, danced at the club when it was popping, when she was like 15 or 16. And this is the song she's dancing to while they're taking shots of her. And she's being cheered on by Donatella in the background. La vérité, mot maudit, mot menti, mot qui manque le fruit d'esprit. Ram sam sam, ram sam sam, kuni 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 kuni, ram sam sam. Does that spark you joy? Does that spark your joy?
That sparks my hoarding instinct of the 80s.
Okay, I'm sorry. I should have said this during the last segment. But in the same way, we are still in the process of coming up with the Wobbler test, which is the official test of a movie to determine the minimum amount of male presence required for men to pay attention to a movie fundamentally about women. I would like to pitch...
Yes.
I would like to pitch...
We have some graphics.
I would like to pitch another Pop Rocket original. It is the Toncare method. The Toncare method is for going through your television and determining what shows you should continue to watch and which shows you need to give up. We will work closely with Karen Tongson to determine what the order is. Do you like this idea or do you find it anathema?
The Toncare, like what you need to keep watching, what you need to give up?
Yeah, and sort of go through it like maybe dramas are closed and you pile those up at the beginning and then eventually you get to like... reality cooking shows.
We could do that. We could do that. We could do that. I am a hoarder of watching things, so it may be like an anti-method. Who knows?
I mean, we could bring
permission
in...
permission to hoard.
My friend Lang Fisher, who is good at getting rid of things, everything in her life except for TV shows, I would love to talk to her about this. I'm sorry that I deflected things. Margaret Wappler. Wife of David.
Mm-hmm.
What is your jam
of
this
David.
Week? Oh, yes, of David. Why don't we call you of David?
We do.
Of David does have a jam.
Okay.
It is sanctioned by him as well. I want to play Sharon Van Etten 17 because this song is basically like if Portishead covered a Bruce Springsteen song.
Oh.
And I am totally here for it. Like dark and murky but muscular and propulsive. Like I just can drive to this song. This is off her new album Remind Me Tomorrow.
That's very Patti Smith-ish but like with electronic background track.
Yeah. There's also some like Arcade Fire sound.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Of Sarah. Do you have a jam?
I do have a jam, and this week in my pop culture class, I taught Back to the Future, so we thought a lot about like moving to and from time, and I came across this song serendipitously, and it's called Future Me Hates Me. And it's by a power pop Kiwi quartet called The Beths, who just released their first full-length album in this past year. They were University of Auckland students who were studying jazz together, but they make wonderful poppy, like kind of indie power pop stuff. And so here's another sunny tune from Oceania, which I seem to be obsessed with recently. Sounds like the 90s. I love it. And these are like young people making things that sound like things that I liked from 20 years ago. So that's my new sweet spot of jams.
Karen, do you think you're going to Oceania a lot because it is summer jam season in the summer in the Southern Hemisphere?
I guess that's what's going on. You know, like I talked about that Australian Airbnb show and now I'm like talking about a New Zealander band. What's happening to me? Hey, Australia. Hey, New Zealand. Hey, Oceania. Invite me out for some talks.
We lost a great this week. We lost Carol Channing, who was an icon. And I think one thing we all for like never a lot of people never knew about her and is not often reported is let us remember that Carol Channing was biracial, that she was her dad was biracial and passed for white. But she for her entire life, once she knew, was very open about the fact that she had African-American ancestry and was proud of it. But Carol Channing was great for so many reasons. The original Lorelei Lee on Broadway. And, you know, once Grace Allen got cancer, was like toured with George Burns. She's had so many careers. And I think
the Love Boat.
And it's so easy to
think Hello, Dolly.
To think of, well, yes.
She went to my middle school.
I mean,
junior high alumni.
It's so easy to think of her as that sort of like Muppetish caricature of a sort of like daffy dumb lady saying raspberries. but to me, the thing that was like great about her was the fact that she was always had access to this like depth of feeling and could give undercurrents of intellect and sorrow to that persona. And to me, the song Before the Parade Passes By from Hello Dolly is really where it comes to its greatest effect.
Look at that crowd up ahead. Pardon me if my old spirit is showing. All of those lights over there seem to be telling me where I'm going. When the whistle blows and the cymbals crash and the sparklers light the sky, I'm gonna raise the roof, I'm gonna carry on. Give me an old trombone, give me an old baton. Before the parade passes by.
I actually think this was previously my jam 1 week for no good reason. I love it. But Carol Channing is great. If you don't know a lot about her, fucking watch Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Please watch Thoroughly Modern Millie this week, please.
A friend and diva to homosexuals of multiple generations.
And she was married to Pinoy.
Yes.
Also, was in fucking Fire Island like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yes.
Like, was doing it for, like, until the end.
This woman gave us almost 100 years of excellence. So exactly. Let's just give her a hand.
Yes.
The posthumous pop rock.
Standing ovation forever.
I can only hope that some 50, 60 years from now, Karen Tongson will be atop a piano, deconstructing popular culture for people before just sliding into
Before the parade.
All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler, Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, and Karen Tongson. Karen, when does the book come out?
The book comes out officially on June 1st, but there will be debut like copies available in April.
Pre-order Why Karen Carpenter Matters.
Oh, I have something to promote this week.
Yes. What's that?
I was on Lady to Lady podcast.
Oh, Lady to Lady is a hell of a podcast.
Yes.
Wow.
With friends of the pod, Barbara Gray, Tess Barker, and
Brandy Posey.
Oh, I mean, if we're doing this, I've got dates. I'm gonna be in Sunnyvale,
Silicon Valley,
the 22nd to like the 24th or something, 2 weekends from now. So if you're in the Bay Area, come and see me. Our theme music is "Party Booby Trap" by Ozzy Muzo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. We have no one to thank this week. Did you notice a little frog in Margaret Wappler's throat this week?
She's dying.
She's illin.
I got a cold, and this is the second illness of 2019 I've gotten. This cannot stand.
She texted us earlier today. She's like, guys, I'm sick again. Sorry.
We need 5 or more 5-star reviews by next week, or who knows what could happen. Next week on the show, we're going to be talking about the Dueling Firefest documentaries and the iconic music festival that never was of the millennial generation. Call my mom's house and leave a voicemail message telling us which of the documentaries you liked better. Her number is 530-237-4108. Or just share your favorite moment from one of them. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join in the Facebook group. You can also find us on Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Shayna Deloria, who hasn't been around in a while. And our senior producer is Laura Swisher, who's always here.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.